Good afternoon, good morning, and good evening, depending on where in the world you are, and thanks for tuning in. My name's John Daniel Trask, and I'm going to be talking today about handling billions of software exceptions with the .NET framework. So as a little bit of a background, I come from a company called Mindscape. We're headquartered in New Zealand, down at the bottom of the world, which is why I sound a little bit different. On top of that, we build a range of products, but I'm going to be talking today about raygun.io. So that's the web address that you can visit us at on the internet. And what Raygun is it's a crash reporting and analytics type solution. So it collects up all of the software problems that are occurring in your code, not that you write bugs, but you know, and sends them off to our service where we do aggregation and alerting and tell you about everything that's been going wrong. Now, the back end of the product is predominantly written using the .NET framework. However, we realize that everybody writes code in all sorts of different languages and platforms these days. So Raygun works with pretty much every platform and language out there. So we've got .NET, obviously, PHP, Python, Swift, Node, the Xamarin stack. All that stuff is handled by Raygun for crash reporting. So, as a little bit of a quick introduction, this is the dashboard of Raygun. And what it shows at the top is the overall trend of errors down to by the hour. You can drill in, you can filter it by time, you can filter by versions. And down here you can see that we've grouped the errors that are occurring. And we create them so that you're not having to deal with 10,000 notifications or 10,000 issues. You're simply kind of going, well, I have one root cause that's occurred 10,000 times and you can go and fix that. So that's the Raygun dashboard, you can drill in. I'm not going to talk the entirety of this session about Raygun itself, but talk about some of the challenges that we've faced in building this product. So it's a hosted service. That means it's running on the cloud. People include a very small library with their product that sends the data to us. And fortunately, it's been growing really well. The challenge with that, however, is the volume of data that's been coming through the doors. So this is kind of the amount of errors that have been flowing through to our service. And you may be wondering to yourself, how buggy can software get, really? You know, well, when we very first launched the service in early 2013, we sort of thought the same. We'd practiced what we preach, which is don't prematurely optimize. And we got it out the door and we soft launched it. And wouldn't you believe, one of the very first users was a Facebook game. Not just any Facebook game, but a top 10 Facebook game. And not just any top 10 Facebook game, but an exceedingly buggy top 10 Facebook game that was drenching us in 3 megabytes a second of crash data, which is quite a lot of exceptions. So right from day one when we launched the service, we were having to look at how to scale and how to improve the performance of the product. And so today, I'm looking at sharing some of the experiences, improvements that we've made to try and handle that level of scale. Another example is how many requests per second that we deal with, where we've peaked at ingesting 110,000 crash reports per second, which is a lot of crash reports. That record is held for a little while when a customer, who shall not go named, but they have 2/3 the active user base of Twitter, and they did a big bang release of the version 2 of their web product where everything broke, like everything. And every time it broke, it sent through to us. So we managed to handle that load as well. Here's an extremely high level diagram of the architecture behind Raygun. So we've got load balancers in front. They come through to API nodes. Then everything goes into queues. Then we have a collection of workers. And then a whole pile of different data storage technologies behind the scenes. So we're going to zoom in on the workers for today's session. And there's a range of different workers that run behind the scenes. Primary workers that effectively validate the input, make sure that it's all looking legitimate. Notification workers, so this is to send you emails. We get people who tell us that sometimes they get the emails before the site's actually put up the 500 page. But also notifications through other channels like HipChat and Slack that people can configure. Secondly, there's pre-processing for things like DSIM files. So if you're doing iOS crash reporting, because keep in mind Raygun works with mobile, web, and desktop products, you're going to get a native crash report, which is not human readable. It's all just hex codes and memory addresses. So a DSIM file is like a PDB in .NET land, and we have to unstitch that to make it human readable for you. Similarly for source maps for JavaScript, which we'll be going into today. And then lastly, the storage workers. So we make a lot of use of Elasticsearch, and we archive things off to Amazon's S3. So as mentioned, we're going to drill in on the source map workers. So for some of you that are not aware of what source maps are, let's say you're a really diligent software developer, you're building a high-performance website, and of course you combine and minify your JavaScript files. The downside of this is when you get a JavaScript error in the browser, you get a message like this. E is not defined, line 1, position 38,920. Now what is this telling us? Well, typically minification is going to be creating a single line JavaScript file, so hence that it's always on line 1, and the offset is somewhere on that massively long line. E is usually just a shortened version of the symbol. So what a source map does is it allows us to take that sort of error and turn it into one that we can understand. So now we can get the symbol that the width is not defined, that the line is actually 482 in our file, and that we're at position 4 in there. So the developers can very quickly jump in and have a look, find the fault, fix it, deploy it, and fix very, very quickly. So that's wonderful. That's a great improvement. So how do we do this? Well, we do this with the source map file. So here's a basic example of a source map file. It's pretty simple. The version, that's the version of the source map specification that we're using here, version 3. The file, the JavaScript file that we are looking to sort of deminify. Source root, if the sources are sitting in other directories, often it's not set. Sources, the files that went into creating the output file. Names. Names are effectively the symbols. So like in the previous example, the word width was the symbol. And then mappings is where the heavy lifting is done. And so mappings is one long string, usually a lot longer than three blocks. And these are what are called VLQs, which is variable length quantity, which you can think of in general terms as being a base 128 sort of character encoding. And you have to sort of sit down and figure out what that computes out to, but it joins the dots fundamentally between the positions and symbols between the name section and what's occurred in the actual stack trace. So a few months ago, I was sort of talking with our CTO about the fact that we were processing a lot of source maps, and he was saying to me, oh yeah, well we've actually got a few servers now that are just crunching source maps all day long. And I was like, oh, really, a few servers? I mean, I know we're doing all right, but a few servers seemed like a lot. And I'm a pretty money conscious guy, so I was like, well, surely we can get more use out of these servers by optimizing this. Now, at the time, what we were using was a V8 process out of Chrome, the JavaScript engine, using the Mozilla standard source map library to do the work. It all seemed to run reasonably all right. However, I thought we could get more oomph out of it. And so we needed to come up with a plan to improve performance. Now, one of the things I wanted to cover today as well is a process for looking at performance improvements, because when it comes to performance work, I'm guilty of this myself, but a lot of developers will take the Tony Stark approach, which is, I have a plan, attack. They don't really plan out what they're going to do. They just jump in and start going nuts. So a couple of my general rules that I try and instill in those in the company around performance work is, firstly, don't waste time. So this is my version of the, premature optimization is the root of all evil quote. Only do performance work if you're sure that you actually need to improve performance. I talk to a lot of startups, and they quite frequently, we're going to ship shortly, but we just have to make sure that we can handle, 25,000 users. It's like, probably not going to have 25,000 users on day one. So don't worry about performance work unless you actually have a reason for it. Secondly, you've got to measure everything, right? You need to have your eye on what's actually taking the time so that you can make sure you're improving the right parts. I know I find this myself, which is that I'll start looking at some code and I think, I know where it's going really slow. And so I'll jump in, start trying to work on that. And I go, oh, I know that bit's faster, but the overall time hasn't really changed. Then I run it through a profiler and discover, actually, I was looking over here, but the big problem's over here. Tools help here. Now, there's a lot of tools. I just wanted to share a couple of them. I personally use the JetBrains profiling tools, but I know in our office, Redgate is also hugely popular with the whole team. They build, both those companies build really great performance profiling and memory profiling tools. Next, do the obvious. We're developers. We like to jump in and sort of come up with these crazy ways of doing things, usually by default. We like to think outside of the box. But more often than not, you can get a lot of performance improvements out of things just by doing the things that are clearly not very performant. If you still can't get the performance you need after plucking all the low-hanging fruit, that's when it's time to think outside the box. And so I remember reading a book a while ago, a great book actually, called Masters of Doom. And it talks about id Software and John Carmack and writing the original game engines for Wolfenstein, Doom, and Quake. And it sort of talks about John Carmack's general approach to performance optimization, which I thought was a really good one, which was start off by doing the obvious. If that doesn't work, that's when you want to start really thinking outside the box. So maybe you've made A, B, and C as fast as they can go and it's still slow. Maybe the answer at that point is to implement X, Y, and Z. But don't do it before doing the easy stuff. Lastly, the fastest you can make something is by not doing it at all. All right. So I love to do nothing. This, by the way, is the first time, and I've done a lot of presentations, that I've ever put a cat picture in a presentation. And it'll probably be the last time. Anyway, an example with source maps for this is one performance improvement that we made previously was a simple check like this, which is if we don't actually have the column offset, there's no way that we can run the source map parser and find the original values. Why would the column ever be null or not provided? Welcome to the wonderful world of old browsers. You know, it's only really somewhat modern browsers that will give reasonable exception reports, including that column offset. I think Chrome's had it a while. Firefox only added it very late last year. And IE has been pretty good at it in the last couple of versions. But this simply means that about 20% of our workload gone. So let's move into some .NET specifics, all right, around performance improvements. And I want to be very clear here that nearly all of these examples are only if it's a performance problem that you're dealing with. Don't take any of these points as being things that you should throw out right away just because I've said that they could have a performance impact. First example is link. Now, link is like the gift that keeps on giving for developers. We can create code, we can do heavy lifting really easily. I mean, I love it. In fact, you know, the best thing about it is how often I'll use link for prototyping type work where I'm kind of going, all right, I need to do this and shift this over here and do that and that. And I end up with this like behemoth of a link query that does all the work. And 99% of the time, that's fine. One of the problems, however, is that link does sort of shift our thinking to being quite generic. And also, link really relies heavily on how the underlying provider operates. So if you think about various link implementations like link to objects, but then there's also, say, link to entities or link that's in our Lightspeed product or in LLB.gen or whatever, all of these different things have their own provider under the hood. And they all have mixed performance characteristics in terms of what they're optimizing for. So you can't really know what they're doing. Link is about expressing intent and then relying on the implementation to be managed behind the scenes. So as an example, take this query here. We're collecting the results. Now, this is from a collection that I ran as a performance test with 100,000 items in it. It's a dictionary where we've got a key, which is an integer, and then we've got values in there that are also just integers. Simple, pretty straightforward. We're looking within a subset of the dictionary for anything that has a value of 1 and then returning a list of that. Pretty straightforward, not very hard, pretty easy to write. Cool. Here's a version of this where we didn't use link. Pretty straightforward, very much not any real additional code. However, the performance implications are substantially different, and it's subtle, but here is the timings from this, which is Link took almost 4 seconds, Link to objects took almost 4 seconds to do this work, while our standard code only took, I think it was about 4 milliseconds, which is why you probably can't even make out the green line down there. Now the subtle reason for this is, if I go back to the code, is in here we have this the effect that we know that the key is an integer. We know that it's ordered, and therefore we're effectively having to do the equivalent of, say, a table scan here to find the items that actually match within those bounds. While in our handwritten code, we're actually smart enough to know that we only need to scan the part that matters. So it's not Link's fault, I'm not saying that at all, and also you wouldn't even probably worry about this unless it was on a critical path that you're trying to improve. But just be a little bit wary that sometimes it's a good low-hanging fruit point to evaluate how much time you're chewing up with a Link query. Secondly, is exceptions. So this here gives an example. I attended a tech ed talk years ago by Andrew Toakley down in New Zealand, and it really sort of stuck in my head about the performance implications of throwing exceptions. Now, we all know that you shouldn't use exceptions for control flow, and you shouldn't throw them unless it's a truly exceptional thing that's happening. Obviously, you know, we don't want to do that. And part of the reason we don't want to do that is actually because of the overhead. It's not the only reason, part of the reason. So I wrote a little test that actually just went and did a count, you know, count things up, and another one that just counted based on throwing an exception to message that we needed to then add something on. And you can see here, I think I was counting 1,000 items. It was very quick to do it without exceptions, but it was about 8 milliseconds per exception in terms of overhead that for throwing them. And so why is that? It's because an exception absolutely chutneys what the runtime is up to. It breaks out of everything. It has to generate a stack trace behind the scenes, which involves seeing all the callers and all that sort of stuff. So generally, if you've got a really tight loop or something going on, you want to avoid sort of doing anything where you might be just throwing an exception just to catch it somewhere else as part of the standard logic. Exceptions should be exceptional. Using less memory. So I've talked a lot so far about speed, but really performance is about maximizing how much we can get out of any resource, and memory in a machine is definitely, you know, a scarce resource. And so we want to try and overall minimize the allocations that we make, so we're not using memory very much. And I think one of the great things about .NET is that, you know, we're abstracted away from having to worry too much about memory. But the unfortunate side effect of that is often we just never think about the memory. And memory can get, you know, used up very easily. And so you want to have a look at some examples. Now, my smells when I'm looking through code and I'm kind of going, why is this using so much memory? JSON, in this age of using, you know, REST for everything and throwing around JSON blobs, that can suck up a lot of memory. XML, the bane of the, you know, sort of mid-2000s when everything seemed to use XML then. And thirdly, regexes. Regexes can actually consume quite a bit of memory if you're not careful. So I tend to look for those when I'm trying to use less memory. The big point though is avoiding the large object heap. So for those of you that are unaware of the way that memory management occurs inside the .NET framework, if an object exceeds 85,000 bytes, so 85,000, it will be put on the large object heap. That means that it doesn't get collected and treated in the same way as smaller allocations. The problem is that you could equally call the large object heap, LOH acronym is standing for lots of holes. So what do I mean by this? Here's an example where, assume we had 16 megabytes of memory, we allocated 16 1 megabyte objects, so we had no memory free. Then we stopped using half those objects and they just happened to be every alternating object. So we've got 8 megabytes free. What happens when we allocate a 5 meg object now? If you guess we got an out of memory exception, you're correct. Because the way the garbage collector works in .NET is that everything that's not on the large object heap will get compacted, meaning that if it had cleared out the alternating items on smaller objects, the end of that, it'll actually clamp them all down, and we then have a large contiguous block of memory available. We don't get that with the large object heap. So you need to be a bit wary when doing this. Now, there are some exceptions to this, which is .NET 4.5.1 includes a garbage collector extension that allows you to suggest to it that it does a single compaction of memory. The other one is that you can get around this by doing things like allocating a large block of memory yourself and then simply inserting objects and pulling them out, so using something like a memory stream. In fact, there's a really great open source project from the Bing team that's been put up on GitHub called the Recyclable Memory Stream. It's a drop-in replacement for the normal memory stream, but it allows you to manage those long-running processes where you're putting things in and out of memory all of the time. I also expect that down the track we'll see improvements in the .NET runtime for handling those the large object heap a little bit better. You may also just be wondering, why don't they do any compaction on the large object heap? When they were originally working on the framework, it was found that the cost of copying objects that exceeded 85,000 bytes actually was more costly than just not doing it at all and having the gaps in memory. So it was a sort of weighing it up. The amount of time that you would have to stop doing any work and shift that memory around meant that it would have too much of an adverse sort of interference on the application. So we've talked about using less memory, but what about accessing memory faster? Again, not something we think too much about with the .NET framework because it abstracts memory away from us in a pretty big way. Take these two loops. Now, map here is a two-dimensional array with 3,000 items in it, 3,000 each way. So it's pretty big. The only difference here is on this inner if statement where we alternate whether we're going via IN or NI. And so you might be thinking, who cares? How much difference does this make? In my tests, one of these loops runs 8 times faster than the other loop. And you might be thinking, well, how can that be? There's no real difference here. What's going on? And this means that we have to think about how the computer actually works underneath. So if you consider this as a simple model, here's our RAM, here's our CPU. You'll be fully aware that, you know, when I access something like my array NI, it's going to go and pull that byte from RAM. RAM's fast, right? It goes to the CPU, CPU does its work, and then moves on to the next one. It would fetch the next piece. What actually occurs in modern computers is that it goes off and gets this item here, but it actually pulls in more. It pulls in more of the memory space than you've actually asked for, and it stores it in the cache on the CPU. Now, the reason for this is partly for performance, because you get something called memory locality performance, which is that if we're storing things, they usually run together. And you can get other sorts of locality improvements as well. But because we know things are often stored together, if we store them in the CPU cache, we can iterate over them much, much faster. And so to put this in perspective of why this is quick, because RAM's quick, right? Here's the relative performance differences between the level 1 cache on your CPU, the level 2, and fetching something from RAM. So the level 1 cache, we can actually pull something from in half a nanosecond. So there's a million nanoseconds in a millisecond. So that's pretty darn quick. The level 2 cache, so level 1 is a per core cache. It's usually pretty small, 32K. Level 2 cache is shared between two cores, so twins. Some CPUs come with a level 3 cache. That's shared amongst the whole CPU, and that's somewhere between here and there. But then RAM. We're talking about 100 nanoseconds to fetch something from RAM. So obviously, if we fetch a chunk and we can put it in one of the caches and operate it on it in the CPU there, we can work a lot quicker. So that's why it goes faster. If we go back to this example here, if we were iterating that loop in the poor performing manner, we might be fetching, you know, the fifth item and then getting the 10th item. And of course, that means that the CPU doesn't have it in its local cache. This works particularly well when it's value types in a collection. It doesn't work quite as well with reference types because often they're simply pointers to the actual objects and they can be otherwhere in other places in memory. You can also run into issues sometimes with garbage collection where things are getting moved around. So it's a little bit one of those things that may or may not work all the time, but in my experience it's generally worked really well when I've been iterating over arrays of value types. Another sort of performance smell that I see a lot is people working with strings and not realizing that they're immutable. What does that mean? It means that they can't be mutated. So take this, I've got a string here, Microsoft, and I go, darn it, I was meant to put a full stop on the end, so string plus full stop character. You've just reallocated that whole block of memory, okay? So you can't just tweak the string. Now there are ways of improving performance around creating strings, so you can use things like string builders to lower the impact, but on the whole, I see people quite frequently not realizing that they're allocating a lot of strings everywhere. When I say a lot of people, I include myself. So, you know, when I sit there and performance profile things, I'll often see something and go, oh gosh, you know, what did I do that for? So here's an example. I'm sure we've all done this. If we were to count the chunks in a comma delimited file, and for simplicity's sake, I'm assuming we haven't escaped any commas here. Seen code like this, string.split by comma and then count the segments, you know. Now, okay, we've done that. What that actually has done is gone and allocated a string for every single chunk that's in there. So we've just potentially, if my string was a very large string, we've allocated a tremendous amount of memory that now has to be garbage collected, takes time to allocate, all of those things. While if we did something more akin to this, keeping in mind that a string is just an array of characters, we can iterate through that string, just count the commas, and then of course, because we always would need to plus one if it was greater than zero, it's on there. So we've just saved a whole lot of allocations occurring, saved a lot of work for the garbage collector, and come out with the same number. The next point I wanted to cover off on was inlining. So inlining is something that is actually done by the compiler, just-in-time compiler as well. Take a simple example here, where if we had a public method, add these together, and it calls another method, you know, that's very simple. The compiler, the just-in-time compiler, it's smart enough to say, this is actually quite wasteful. Why am I bothering to call this other method? Why don't I just inline it? And so that's exactly what it does, is it goes, well, actually, I can substitute this in and automatically, and you know, do the work without incurring the cost of method invocation. Why would we care about the cost of method invocation? I mean, method invocation is actually very, very quick. I read a paper the other day from 2004 on the .NET framework that was saying that they'd measured it at, I think it was 7 nanoseconds for a method invocation. However, it stacks up because, and I'll give an example with our source map stuff shortly, but if you end up where you're calling a method millions and millions of times, that time actually gets quite high. Now, inlining actually happens automatically. You don't have to worry about it. Except normally when you want to either generate a particular stack trace, which I don't advise, and Scott Hanselman has a great article on that. If you Google release debug 64-bit stack trace, I'm sure his article will come up first. But the way that it happens automatically is compiler's going to look at the amount of IL that's in there, so the intermediate language that's generated by the C# or VB compiler or whatever .NET platform you're targeting. If it's less than 32 bytes, then it's a candidate, but it has to also be a non-virtual method. It can't have any exception handling. It can throw an exception, but it can't have a try-catch block inside it. It can't be a marshal by ref object, because it could be a proxy object that's partway through. There's a whole bunch of rules. They're not especially well documented anywhere, although I think now that things are getting more open sourced by Microsoft, you could probably dive in and see the exact characteristics that trigger it. But it's going to happen automatically. The problem arises when you want to force inlining. So for example, you might have a large method that you know you're going to get better performance out of if you could inline, and if it breaks the 32 byte thing, what can you do? You can put an attribute in there. This was added to the framework, I think in 3.5, where you can request aggressive inlining. And aggressive inlining will effectively say, disregard the size check, and just throw it in there. And I'll talk a little bit more about inlining shortly. Lastly, release mode, or more importantly, the /o attribute on the compiler, which is to apply optimizations. Now, I've done this myself and it's been a mistake, but I sometimes see people running profilers against the debug version of their code. Now, why is this a mistake? Well, quite frequently, you'll end up where you're making some micro optimizations that the compiler would have done for you for free anyway. So I've seen that with certain libraries that we've used in the past where you can tell that the developer has just ended up effectively doing the compiler's job for it, or the optimizer's job for it, by optimizing their default state. So I always like this though at the end. I frequently see somewhere between a sort of 30 and 60% performance increase once I enable the compiler optimizations. So remember to check that when you're actually doing your timings on your code. I like to get to the end and kind of go, cool, I've made this really fast, and, well, that's right, optimizations, and then, whoa, free sort of 2x speed up. Let's get back on topic though. Source maps. So I had this problem, multiple servers, wanted to make this thing faster, didn't want to have to keep paying for servers. Let me walk you through the process of what actually happens with a source map file. So we get this string come in, right? And it's the JSON, raw JSON format document for the map file. So the example like I showed you earlier. We then have to iterate through all of those VLQ encoded blocks. Part of that involves translating those VLQ encoded blocks. Then, once we've got a full set, we do a binary search over that data that we've now transformed to find the original location in the original JSON JavaScript file. And then we return the result. Pretty straightforward process. First thing we did to try and improve performance is we handcrafted our own JSON parser. Now, I don't recommend this to people generally. We were using JSON.NET, and that's a fine library. Whole lot of flexibility, whole lot of sanity saved. The reason that we wanted to use our own JSON parser was because we were having some difficulties as well around the memory consumption. Now, when JSON.NET parses a JSON file, it does allocate things on the large object heap. Not usually a problem, but we wanted to make sure we minimized memory usage. So we also knew that we had a very strict format to what a source map needed to look like. We knew that once we'd read through it once, we never needed to look at it again. We never had to run any link queries using, JSON.NET has a link implementation for needing to pull things out. So we had a very special case where we didn't need all of the capabilities of a fully fledged JSON library. The upside of this was we ended up where we didn't have to allocate anything onto the large object heap. In fact, we even managed to minimize overall allocations in general. And this resulted in two outcomes. One, the whole process is 3 to 5 times faster than JSON.NET because we didn't have to maintain an internal model. We just screamed through, got what we needed. It gets faster the bigger the file. So if somebody had a multi-megabyte map file, it would come through, you know, and process a lot quicker than JSON.NET was. And we ended up with 40% less memory being used than when we had the JSON.NET implementation. So that really helped bring it right down. Next, we had to parse the file to the end. And so when I was looking at this, and I effectively was just reviewing the Mozilla implementation and then writing my own version in .NET, I was kind of like, this is kind of weird. It goes through, and they're doing things like regular expressions to check for those commas or semicolons. And I was like, well, first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to take out regular expressions. Firstly, I don't know about you guys, but I'm just afraid of regexes, even if they're basic. But I don't like them. And all I had to do was a character check to say, is it a comma or is it a semicolon? And that was it. So that was a minor speed boost. The real big speed boost, however, came from being able to short circuit the whole process. So when I'm parsing through those VLQ encoded bits, if I find the one that actually matches what I was originally looking for, why would I bother to complete the parse at all? Why don't I just return the result right now? And so I put that in, and that made a tremendous boost because unless the actual mapping that we're trying to create is the last thing in the entire file, we never have to parse the entire file. So that's a big win. And like I say, you can't make something faster than just not doing it at all. Then we had the VLQ translation part. Now, admittedly, VLQ translation in the Mozilla library was already pretty quick. As a bit of background, VLQ sort of format and encoding was actually created way back in the day for the MIDI sound format. So for computers that had very little sort of storage memory capacity to do anything. And so it's a fairly optimized, compacted format. So there wasn't too much I could do to make the overall process quicker because it's already doing bit shifts and things like that. But I did end up where I made a lookup table for parts of it, so that helped, so that I wasn't having to compute things, I was just pulling things out of an array. And then secondly, I had this really tricky problem where I couldn't get one of the methods in the VLQ translation to be automatically inlined. And looking at the different heuristics that .NET has around when it inlines, I couldn't figure out which thing it was actually preventing it from being automatically inlined, so I ended up manually inlining the method. Now this actually improved performance tremendously, because by the time you got into doing the VLQ translation right in the core, it was getting called millions of times. For the jQuery source map file, for example, my test, it was about 9.5 million calls to it. And then think back to that method invocation cost of, say, 7 nanoseconds, you start going, well, this is actually several milliseconds that I'm losing here just for the overhead of calling this method. So that sped things up quite a bit. Lastly, the binary search. So normally we would have parsed the whole thing, then had to go hunting. So first thing I did was I improved the comparison of strings to make sure that it was about as quick as I could. But, you know, it's a binary search. It's pretty quick. There's not too much I could do in here, except for the fact that because I short-circuited the parse, most of the time I never actually even had to run the binary search at the end. So that was a pretty big win for us. So that was my overall approach to trying to improve the performance of the source map parser and runner for us. So how did we actually do? I mean, this is all well and good, and it took me, I think, a long weekend to do this. How much did we really get out of going to all this effort? Well, effectively, we ended up where we were running 202 times faster. So we went from multiple machines that were running all day long doing source map work using V8 and the Mozilla implementation, and we dialed it right back down to needing one core on one machine that could do our current entire daily workload in about 20 minutes. So this was a big saving for a few days worth of work, get rid of some servers, give us a whole lot more capacity for growth in the future, continue handling more errors. So that, on the whole, is where we ended up, and I hope you found that useful. We're gonna get ready for some questions. Hopefully you've put some into the website that aren't too hard. And while I'm answering those questions, I'll leave this up. Thank you very much for watching. I am on Twitter. I associate a lot of my value with Twitter. No, not really. But you can tweet me at TraskJD, or you can email me at jdtrask@raygun.io. I especially like sharing any performance tips and things like that. So I do blog occasionally on the Raygun site about it. But if you have any sort of suggestions, ideas, things like that you'd like to kick around, I do like people to get in touch. So give us a yell. Now, like the last session, I'll see if any questions come up on the TV that's right in front of me. And at the moment, there are none. They could improve the performance on this. Let's see. Are we going to get any? There we go. Greg, I get the fragmentation of the large object heap being a problem, but how is its use a performance issue, and how did reducing its use help with performance of Raygun.io? It's a great question. Effectively, the source map processing is like a long-running process because we're having to process so many source maps. The issue is that because of the fragmentation that was occurring, we would often end up in the situation where it would appear that there was lots of free memory. So you might go, oh, well, there's 500 megs of free memory on this box, but .NET couldn't allocate into it because it was so fragmented. So a way of thinking about this is, if you remember, you know, that defrag program that used to come like on Windows 95 and it had the really like psychedelic trippy diagram as it was doing things. It's sort of similar to that, where if you've just got lots of holes in memory, .NET can't just allocate into those slots. It can only allocate into contiguous blocks. So while we were running all of this stuff, we had the issue that we would start running into out-of-memory issues, which would slow down being able to actually process more source maps until we freed that memory, which meant we were waiting on the GC. And GC, you know, you're not meant to try and control that. So that impacted the performance of that. And we wanted to make sure that when we get source maps in, for example, that as soon as people get that email, and you'll remember from the workers that we send an email pretty much as soon as we receive an error, we want to make it so you get that email, you click that link, you're in Raygun, and it's automatically been sorted out. So any delays in that pipeline are really bad. Cool. So next question, also from Greg. Love you, Greg. Also, how did you reduce large object heap usage in Raygun? Any specific techniques? The big one there is effectively not having to continually allocate large objects. So as I mentioned, the JSON parser that we wrote ourselves. So JSON.NET is going to build up a whole lot of stuff behind the scenes so that it can work with that file quickly at the end. We didn't want to do that. So there was, when I was doing the memory profiling, effectively when we would call the JSON.parse method using JSON.NET, there would be this initial spike in memory usage, and then it would drop back down to about half of where it was. Now most of that was sort of large object heap related, and so what we ran into is if we could just get rid of that, then we knew that we actually could double the amount of source map processing by itself. So that was one example of reducing it. The other one is strings get long. So I'm not talking about the little example where I sort of said Microsoft plus a full stop, but take, for example, that VLQ string in the JSON file. That guy can get really, really long, like, you know, hundreds of kilobytes, even megabytes in length. And so you want to make sure that if we're going to touch that giant string, that we really make sure that we're not carving, you know, not splitting it just in half and doing things like that would also end up going on the heap. Cool. Next question from Henry. Can you open source your JSON parser? You're not the first person to ask, Henry. I might do this. My biggest concern with it is it's designed entirely for parsing that source map specific format. So I kind of want to put it up, but at the same time, I don't want to suddenly get a flood of GitHub issues from people saying, well, it can't parse my crazy, you know, my crazy JSON file. For example, there's no nesting in the source map specification file. So there's no sort of sub collections in there. So I don't even have to look for it. And again, this is where you may still find that it's better to use a library like JSON.NET, which is highly optimized, but has more flexibility. Cool. David, why is JSON a memory smell? Because JSON.NET or other libraries may use as much memory. The only reason I call it a smell is because I know that typically JSON blobs are going to be big, right? And because of that, I know that if we're dealing with a lot of JSON files, which we do with Raygun, as an example, every error crash report that gets sent to us is a JSON blob, and they are typically about 100K in size. And suddenly, if you're getting 110,000 crash reports per second, as we did peak at, suddenly you've got a problem when it comes to memory management. That was absolutely not an issue relating to JSON.NET or the other libraries. It was just an optimization for us. And this comes back to looking at your own problem domain and finding exactly what things you can improve around the performance specific to your domain. Next question, why doesn't .NET garbage collect the large object heap instead of throwing out of memory exceptions? Well, the thing is, it does collect off the off the large object heap. It doesn't leave them sitting there forever. However, if you imagine three blocks, one, two, three, and it collects, well, actually, we're going to need more than that. Let's say four blocks. And it collects this one and the last one, so the second and the last one. And you need to allocate something that takes two blocks, then it can't allocate that because there's not a contiguous block of memory. So it's not that it doesn't collect it. It's just that it doesn't compact it down. It doesn't take out those two blocks and then smash the remaining two together so that we have one contiguous big block at the end. As mentioned, you can actually cause it to do a compaction on the large object heap in .NET 4.5.1. However, the reason it doesn't do it was for very good reasons in the first place, which is if you imagine a really, really, really large object in memory, you might suddenly have to stop the world of your app for, you know, 250 milliseconds or something where it just isn't responding because the garbage collector is having to compact large objects. I hope that helps. Have you seen a lot of performance hits when using try-catch blocks? Because in some cases you can't get around them. No, you're absolutely right. You actually do want to make sure you are handling exceptions that you can expect to happen. An example of this is that front worker in our flow where we receive errors, right? And they come onto a queue and then we have to examine that they are valid. We obviously have to put a try-catch block around that when we try and parse it into our format in case somebody's sent some junk or something's not been encoded correctly. You have to have it there. It's just a case where you really should be trying to make sure that that's exceptional, not the norm for throwing exceptions. And in our case, usually, if something comes through to us and it's not valid, it's for two reasons. Either we're testing a new version of a provider ourselves and we've goofed in how it encodes things, or secondly, somebody else is trying to write a provider for Raygun and they don't quite know or haven't read the spec properly, in which case we can get in touch with them to try and improve that. So all of our providers, for example, are open source, so you can jump in and look at the .NET one or the Go one or the PHP one. And so people quite often are porting support for Raygun to different platforms. Next question. So two questions. So the back end side of Raygun uses .NET too. Do you use F# for anything? Most of the back end of Raygun is in .NET. We do the DSIM work using Go. The API nodes are currently running in Node.js, but all of the other workers, the website, the public website, all of that stuff is pure .NET. At the moment, we're not using F#. I've actually done work in F# before, and we have used F# extensively. We write a product called Web Workbench, and that was using F# for a whole lot of parsing work. We just haven't used it in here yet. No particular reason. One of the guys that loved F#, moved on. That was about it. How do you see the compiler optimizations? I'm guessing decompiling the release assembly, right? Basically, that's what you got to do. I often find that I notice them more when I'm running the performance profilers, where I'm looking at the timings per sort of block of code, and you'll see something and you'll go, well, wait a minute, that doesn't match my code. And in that Scott Hanselman post that I mentioned, this was where sometimes you'll see a stack trace and you'll think to yourself, well, hang on a minute, I know that there's like three different methods it has to go through to get here. And that's a sign that inlining has occurred, because those methods were no longer in the call stack because they've been inlined. So I normally see it in the profiler. I'm pretty big on the fact that I kind of want, especially in our line of work where performance is very important, I like to see the performance profiler on one of the monitors, so that people are actually just running these performance checks all the time, because it's really interesting, even if you're not doing performance work, to run that stuff just to actually sanity check where the work is going in your code, because 9 times out of 10 I find I've thought that the work is going on somewhere else and it's actually happening in a completely different part of my code base. The next question from Chaz. Are there any performance benefits or situations where unmanaged code could be used? Absolutely. There is, the thing is with any managed language, you're getting a lot given to you for free. You get a lot of benefits in terms of your own productivity. Take the Link example that I gave. I still use Link absolutely everywhere. It's hugely powerful. However, when you abstract things away, you lose the fine-tuned control that you would normally have. And so it's a trade-off. It's always a trade-off. And the same comes with an unmanaged language. So for example, if you were to pick, say, raw C++, hey, cool, you can get down and do crazy stuff in there. One of the examples being the recent sort of Haswell chips have come with a really cool new locking opcode that can run in hardware, so around the TSX spec. But you can't access that or control it using .NET. You'd just hope that at some point the .NET framework will actually support this opcode in one of their locking things so that they're handling the unmanaged part. So you can always do interesting stuff in an unmanaged language, but if you actually sort of think and profile and put some thought into the overall process of what you're doing, I think you can usually get a lot of bang for buck out of a managed language. I mean, we're processing quite a lot of data. And I think I've only heard one conversation in our office where we thought maybe we should just write this thing in C++, and then it was kind of like, yeah, cool, but the deadlines might move out. So yeah, it's a seesaw. Pick, you know, weigh it up. Cool. Last question, I think. How did you do the binary search? The source should be sorted for it to work. How did you handle that? It should be sorted, and there was sorting code in there, but also what you'd find is that when you parse those VLQ strings is that they're actually naturally ordered anyway, which is why the partial lazy sort of evaluation of the VLQ blocks works in the first place, because it was already ordered for you. So I didn't have to really do much. In fact, I ended up taking out the sorting code to begin with because it didn't have to be done. Cool. More questions, cool. How do you handle logging in Raygun? Any specific library or technique to minimize the impact of logging? I'm going to assume in this you mean about logging just generally about our own infrastructure and what's going on. I'm a big fan of hosted logging services, the likes of LogEntries, where you can set it up and just pump logs off to those things. We have a lot of people that want to use Raygun for logging as well, but at the moment it's focused on crash reporting. But yeah, we're big on using either cloud-based services, so we run a bunch of things there, and then also we have built up our own sort of monitoring systems as well, where we track, you know, memory from various things. I think we've also got tools like Librato in the mix to track statistics about things. So it's a real mishmash that's in there. But we haven't really seen anything that's had too much overhead. Next question from James. When you decide to inline a chunk of code instead of losing performance from adding a method call, does that often negatively affect readability? And if so, what is the happy medium? So you hit on a great point there, James, which is, firstly, when you actually write performant code, it's normally really ugly to read, right? It is not attractive code because you've done everything you can to try and make it perform well. When it comes to writing high performance code, I comment crazily. Every single thing I'm changing, there'll be a whole write-up about why I'm doing this, because it's so easy when you pick up code to jump in, have a look at something and go, oh man, that's pretty, I'll just fix this up, and suddenly your performance has just been lost. So comment copiously. When it came to the inlining, I mean, the thing that I didn't like about it was this particular method had, it was quite small, which is why I wasn't sure why it wasn't being inlined in the first place, but it got called from two places, so I ended up with duplication of the content. Now, the plus side of it being quite small is that it didn't have too much impact on the attractiveness of the code, but I needed to make sure that if I ever found a bug in one of those lines that I remembered to change the other one, so comment to that. Key thing is that the just-in-time compiler and everything is smart enough to do most of the inlining for you most of the time. So it's not normally something you have to worry about it looking ugly. The framework and the whole runtime is designed to quite like small methods. That allows it to do more inlining. I haven't had too much trouble with it being ugly. Having said that, I'm talking about my code. You ask anybody I work with, they might tell you it's the ugliest code they've ever seen. But anyway, thanks very much for watching, guys. I really appreciate having had you tune in. And again, if you have any questions, ping me via email or on Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks very much.